Hi, good morning, everyone. Today, of course, is the third of Sivan, and this is a very important day because this is the first of the 3 days of preparation before Matan Torah, the third, the fourth, and the fifth, called Shlosha Shemei Hagbalah. But interestingly enough, the day yesterday, the second day, also has a title. It is called Yom Miyuchas, and it's a bit of a mystery, the day of Yichus. Why is it called Yom Miyuchas? So I'll give you two explanations why it's called Yom Miyuchas. One explanation is Yichus is often what we have when we don't have anything else. So we can sometimes have Yichus in who comes after us and Yichus in who comes before us. So Memela, the second day of Sivan is sandwiched between Rosh Chodesh and Shlosha Shemei Hagbalah. But it itself does not have any distinction. So it's called the Day of Yichus because it's connected to an important day before and an important day afterwards. But in a more serious vein, there's another reason why it's called Yom Miyuchas, and that is before Matan Torah, there were a number of communications from Hashem to Moshe and from Moshe to Bnei Yisrael. And if you look at the Chumash, you'll figure out they came to Har Sinai Rosh Chodesh Sivan. But the Gemara tells us on Rosh Chodesh Hashem didn't do any communicating because people needed to rest from their travels. So even HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows you have to rest after a trip. But the first communication was the second day of Sivan. And that first communication was, you shall be for me a mamleches kohanim, a kingdom of priests, and a goy kadosh, and a holy nation. That is our yichus. That is our lineage. We are mleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. So on the second day of Sivan, we were given our mission statements. We were given our destiny, our job description, so to speak. And that is why it is called Yom Miyuchas. It reminds you of a beautiful word from the Sfas Emes. It's not even in the Sefer. It's just like a joke that is said over, where Hasidim came to him and they said, what's a good segula? You know, segula is like you look for some magical trick. What's a good segula for Hashem's brachos? So he says, the best segula for Hashem's brachos is v'hayisam li segula mikol ha'amim. If you become a segula, that's a segula. They also say a great segula for Parnassa, which has worked ever since Adam HaRishon, is to get a job. But okay, that's a... They say it's a very ancient segula. Okay. But some schoolists are not so popular, I don't know. But anyway, so what I want to talk about today is I want to, number one, continue with the Aseres HaDibros, and then if there's time, maybe again share some general thoughts about Shavuos. We are in the middle of the second group of commandments. Now again, it's not the second commandment because in that second grouping, there are a number of commandments. The commandment against believing in other idols, the commandment in worshiping them, the commandment in owning them, in making them, etc. So it actually includes four different commandments. But at the end, at the end, there is a theological statement of great import. Because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. I'm just translating. Kel Kana, Poked Avon Avos Albanim. I will visit the sin of the fathers unto the children. Ad Shleishim V'ad Rebeim L'Sonoi, until the third generation. That would actually already be the grandchildren, or the great-grandchildren, because there's three generations beyond the sinner. V'ad Rebeim, and one more generation, L'Sonoi, those who hate me. V'yose Chesed Le'alafim, and I do loving kindness to the 2,000th generation. Li'ohavai, to those who love me. L'shomrei mitzvosai, and to those who keep my commandments. Now, Rashi already points out that the Torah seems to indicate that at least to a limited extent, future generations get punished for the sins of the parents. Meaning, if I do an Aveira, theoretically the Onesh could go unto the fourth generation. Putting aside the question, why do you mention the third if it goes to the fourth? And that's actually superfluous as well. Just say Adri Beyim. But Rashi raises the question, it's really from the Medrash, that does not the Torah say in the book of Devarim, in Parshas Shoftim, Lo Yumsu Avos Albanim,
Parents do not get punished for the sins of their children. Ubanim al ha'avos. Nor do children get punished for the sins of their parents. Ish b'cheto yumas. Each person is responsible for their own sin. God does not believe in intergenerational guilt. So it's a kasha.
So how could the Torah say God visits the sins of the parents unto the children? So Rashi gives the following answer, which is not as simple an answer as you would think. Rashi says there's a distinction between children who follow and endorse the ways of their parents and children who do not follow and endorse the wicked ways of their parents. When they follow and endorse the wicked ways of their parents, that is called Ochez Masa Aveseim Biadeim, then God will punish them for the sins of the parents. When they turn their back on the sins of the parents, then indeed they are not culpable. But the Maharal says that Rashi's answer, which is really from the Gemara, Rashi's answer is not really such a good answer. Because even if a child follows the sinful path of their parents, they should get punished for their sin. And there's, Rashi seems to be setting up the idea. I'm going to use numbers just as an example. Let's assume that the parents committed sins that are equal to 1 million units of culpability. And the children commit sins that are equal to 1 million units of culpability. The implication of Rashi is, since the children are following in the way of the parents, they'll get punished with 2 million units. But that's not fair. At most, we should say, if they follow the path of their parents, they'll get punished for their averus. Why would they get punished for the averus of their fathers? So the Maharal explains that the concept is really this. The concept is, spiritually, there is a unity of all souls. In effect, everything that one neshama does is done by all neshamas. The same way that when my hand does a crime or a mitzvah, it's not my hand doing it, it's me doing it. So too, since all neshamas are united in one shoresh, in truth, everything that anybody does should be passed down, past, future, etc. But in Hashem's rachamim, when you disassociate yourself from the evil of the past, it's as if you amputated yourself from that particular aspect of reality. But in the absence of amputation, you become, meaning a future generation, becomes a co-conspirator, even in the evils of the past. Now that's an amazing thing. Think about, for example, a neo-Nazi. Now you say a neo-Nazi, which unfortunately we have, didn't kill any Jews. A neo-Nazi did not actively participate in the Holocaust. But what Rashi is teaching is, if you endorse, if you validate, if you support the evil, Hashem will hold you responsible, even for the evil that you had nothing to do with directly, because you're connected in that way. Of course, the Maharal points out, even in this collective guilt, there is a certain midah of rachamim. Because the Maharal points out, if Hashem takes a punishment and he spreads it over 4 generations, that means each individual person gets less punishment than he would get had it all been poured in one way. Of course, the other aspect is this. It's important to note that this pasuk of Poked Avon Avos only appears by idolatry. It does not appear by the other averos. And here, there might be a special point for idolatry. Because the Gemara tells us normally an evil thought is not counted as a deed. If I think I want to desecrate Shabbos and I didn't, I don't have an avera. But the one exception is idolatry. A thought to worship other gods is treated as bad as a maisa. So it might be, although this is probably not what Rashi is saying, that when the Torah says later generations can be punished for the sins of the earlier generations, if they support them, that might be unique to Avodah Zarah, because by Avodah Zarah, even the thought, the machshava, is considered to be a maisa. But the other way around is also true. When we endorse the goodness of our prior generations, even to the 2000th generation, Hashem makes us a part of that goodness, even if we're not able to live up to that standard. It's very, very beautiful. If I look at what my ancestors did, and I admire it, I emulate it, I want to be a part of it, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me the reward for their good deeds, even though I myself am not on that madrega. That's exactly the meaning of Zechus Avos, the merit of my forefathers. But here is the important point. In order to... Yeah, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. What are we doing here? Thank you. Okay. In order to get Zechus Avos, I have to affirm and believe what my Avos lived for. You see,
this reminds me, Mahshava, the individual, Kamaseh,
right.
Harim,
That's right. Now, this is a beautiful point the Ramban makes. The Ramban makes a very interesting point. By the Chet HaEgel, when the Jewish people sinned with the golden calf, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Moshe is praying that Hashem shouldn't destroy the Jewish people, Moshe uses two arguments to God. Two different arguments. One argument is, Lama Yomer HaGoyim, you know, if you destroy the Jewish people, the Goyim will say, like we always say, what do the Goyim say? The Goyim will say, you didn't have power to help them. We'll call that Chilul Hashem. Your name will be desecrated. The other is, remember the merit of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Huh? Well, yeah. So two things, Chilul Hashem and Zechus Avos. Now, after the... Yeah. Yes. You have the... Yes, in the Egel, however, yeah, that's true. In the Egel, that wasn't said, though. In the Chet HaEgel, it was the Zechus Avos. Now, by the Meraglim, which happened less than a year later, by the Meraglim, Moshe, when Hashem also wanted to destroy the nation, and then he decided to let them wander for 40 years, you find the only argument Moshe uses is Chilul Hashem and also the Rachamim of Hashem, but he does not use the merit of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Listen to what the Ramban says. The Ramban says you can only invoke Zechus Avos when you endorse and stand for what the Avos represented. When you turn your back on what the Avos lived for, you cannot invoke Zechus Avos. It's like the old joke about the person who kills his parents and then says to the court, have mercy on me, I'm an orphan. Of course, keep in mind, this is an old joke. I heard this joke 50 years ago, but it was used in California, where unfortunately some teenagers killed their parents and they made the argument, we're orphans, we're all alone in the world. Okay, so the joke of one generation becomes the reality of the next generation. But here's the thing. So listen to what the Ramban says. The Ramban says, the Chet HaEgel, as serious as it was not a repudiation of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Because the Chet HaEgel, they also believed in Hashem. They made a mistake. They thought they would need intermediaries. But fundamentally, they had emunah in Hashem. The Meraglim, they repudiated the blessings of Eretz Yisrael, which the Avos were so moser nefesh to be connected to Eretz Yisrael. How Avram Avinu paid 400 shkalim, an exorbitant amount, much more than 400 shkalim today, to have a burial ground for Sarah. So you reject what was most beloved to the Avos, and you now ask me to save you in the merit of the people that you reject? So that's exactly the symmetry in the Pasuk, because the Pasuk is basically saying, when you endorse the evil of the past, you are connected to that evil of the past. But when you endorse the goodness of the past, you are connected to that goodness, even if you're not living up to that madrega, because we're not on the madrega, certainly of the Avos. But the Zechus Avos continues to help us if we affirm that we believe in what they believed in, what they stood for. And that's important to us. Rabbeinu Yaina says in Mishle, on a pasuk, Ish lefi mahalolo, a person according to his praises. A person is judged according to his praises. Rabbeinu Yona says the following pshat. Sometimes a person is not judged by how they behave, because sometimes for the Yetzer Hara, our behavior is less than it should be. But a person is judged by Hashem by what they truly believe is right. So, Amal, you can have a person, let's say, even a person who's from and learning, but that's not really what he admires in life. What he admires in life is someone who makes a lot of money or whatever. And sometimes you have the opposite, a person who may not be externally so religious, but he really loves people who learn Torah, who do mitzvahs. And Rabbeinu Yonah says a large component of the din of Shemayim is what we truly love and respect in life, even if we don't live up to that level all the time. And that, I think, does tie into this idea that when you're makasher yourself to the goodness of the past, you get schar for it, even though you may not be living up to that standard. And that's right, chesed le'alafim. Did you want to say? Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, certainly, on some level, if there is indeed intergenerational punishment, depending how you understand it, that would be part of what's going on with tzaddik v'ra'lo. On the other hand, if we assume that the tzaddik does not accept the rishis of the past, then it's hard to see how he could be responsible in any way. Tzaddik v'ra'lo is a mystery in and of itself. By the way, I happen to be talking about it tonight somewhere, so you can hear. I'll give you a little advance, but basically, I mean, you know, as you know, this was the one question that Moshe asked Hashem. That Hashem said, "I'm not giving you the answer." So it is a mystery to Moshe. It's a mystery to Eev. It's a mystery to David. A mystery to Habakkuk. We can go through so many Nevi'im. And there are many approaches, and there's lav dafke, a single answer. There is no single answer. But one answer in many cases is that sorrows are vehicles for self-transformation and growth, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives the tzaddikim those experiences in life, even if they're very, very difficult, to enable their inner potential to be realized in ways that would not come out in the normal course of life. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik once gave a very, very interesting Mushel. There was a man in Brisk who was very wealthy, and he gave tzedakah, and he was generous and a tzaddik, and he learned, and he did everything right. He raised his children in a very good way, and then one day everything was lost. He was reduced to extreme poverty, and nobody understood this. I mean, he was a person, he served Hashem in every good way. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said that life is like a school. Imagine a person goes to school and he masters like one field. But then he decides, or then Hashem decides, you have to now, okay, you've mastered one field perfectly. Now it's time to give you another education, another field, another challenge. So all the facets of your personality can come out. So he says, here was a man who mastered the difficult nisayon of living with wealth. That is a difficult nisayon. I mean, I wouldn't know, but they tell me. They tell me it's a difficult nisayon. Even more difficult than poverty. He mastered it. There's no other place he can go with it. He reached the highest level. So now he starts anew with a different type of schooling. And you know, as it is, when you start a new school, you're always starting at the bottom, right? What did one kid say? One kid said, life is a continual succession of reaching the top and then starting at the bottom. He says, you know, you finish kindergarten, then you got to start first grade, and then you graduate middle school, seventh grade, you know, whatever it is. Then you got to start at the bottom in high school. He says, that's what it is. He reached the top. Now he starts from the bottom. And he'll pass that test too, Rav Chaim said. You know, so these are, these things are much easier to say than to actually integrate within our personalities, but this is what it's about, vehicles of self-transformation. That's why the Satan in the book of Eev is making a very good point. If you look at the book of Eev, you know, you find that the Satan kind of plays a bet with God. Hey God, Eev is a good guy because he gets everything he wants. So let's start taking things away and let's see. And because I bet you. And Hashem seems to say, oh, I accept your bet. Let's see. The truth of the matter is, obviously, it's a much more profound discussion than that. The Satan is making the point that Eev's goodness is not truly goodness unless he serves you, even though he's not getting short-term benefits. And therefore the Satan is saying, if you truly want Eev to be a tzaddik, he must go through these experiences in order to become the person he's able to become. So intergenerational guilt might be a part, although it doesn't seem to fit Rashi. I mean, if Rashi is saying you only get that punishment if you endorse, that would not seem to fit the tzaddik. Of course, another approach, which Lahavdil is the same as Buddhism, but it's within Judaism, is the notion of reincarnation, of Gilgal. I mean, the Ramban actually says that sometimes the tzaddik suffers in the world because of the averos, not of his ancestors, but of his own neshama in a prior life. The Ramban uses Gilgal as a partial response. Gilgal is controversial. People always ask me, or ask other people as well, do you have to believe in reincarnation? Well, I mean, I don't have an answer to that. It's not in the Gemara. It's not one of the 13 principles of faith. So the Gemara and the Medrash do not mention Gilgal. Gilgal is a very big theme in Kabbalah and in the writings of the Ari. So I would have to say, you know, we honestly don't know, since we don't really penetrate the world of Kabbalah. We're not entirely sure, but in the mainstream of Kabbalistic thought, certainly Gilgal is an accepted idea, but you wouldn't be an apikoris. You might be wrong, but you wouldn't be an apikoris if you didn't believe in this. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It seems not. It seems there has to be kind of an endorsement of the same type of evil. Like a neo-Nazi would be a good example, where he kind of endorses. Now, there might be yet another perspective on the notion of children bearing the sins of their fathers. And that is, it might not be in the nature of punishment, but it might be in the nature of consequence. By that I mean that if a person lives a life of evil, it is likely that the children will be swept up in it. There'll be a formative influence. It will influence them. So the Torah doesn't mean they're going to get punished for the sins of their fathers, but in this sense, the sins of their fathers caused them to be sinful, and therefore they're getting punished for their sins, which come from the sins of the fathers. See, a little different. It's not that God is going to punish them for what their parents did, but rather, because of what their parents did, that's why they sinned. So in effect, we're telling the parents, even if you don't care about yourself, at least care about your children, because you're creating a circumstance where your children are going to suffer because of the sins that you do. But you see, it's not that father was Mechalel Shabbos, so child will get punished for that Chilul Shabbos. But rather, if the father's Chilul Shabbos caused the child to be Mechalel Shabbos, then in effect the child is suffering. By the way, in the bracha that we say at a bar mitzvah, it's machlokis if you say it at a bas mitzvah, the minhag here is not to, but Baruch Sheptarani Meyon Shel Shelzeh. A person says, Baruch Hashem, that I am pater from the onesh. So there are two interpretations. Some say that when your child is not yet bar mitzvah, you're responsible for them, so you get punished for them. See, Baruch Hashem, I'm not responsible for him, he's on his own, which is a little callous, you would think. Baruch Hashem, you know. But some say a very different pshat. Some say that Ptarani Meyoncho Shelzeh, meaning I have been released from being the source of my child's punishment. That some say a different pshat, that when a child is a katan, he's not a separate person, then sometimes a parent gets punished by what happens to a child, because the child is not a separate person. So the parent is giving gratitude that the child will no longer be caught up in the parent's sins, which I think is, although it's all still a little morbid, but I think it's a bit more loving than the other interpretation. That Baruch Hashem, my child, in other words, Hashem has released me from being a source of onesh to the child. Okay, so that's that. Commandment which ends with the theological reflection of the notion of some level of collective guilt. But again, the last thing I said, there's no doubt that that's true. That if we create the atmosphere
which causes our children to sin. They're getting punished for their sins, but they wouldn't have had that without the negativity we infused. So in effect, they are suffering because of us, right? There's no question. They are suffering because of us. Now, we then come to the third group of commandment, and I'll just relatively short, but just a few comments on this. Lo sisa es shem Hashem Elokecha lashav. Do not bear the name of God in vain. Ki lo yinake Hashem. God will not forgive or exonerate. Es asher yisa es shemo lashav. He who takes God's name in vain. Now, what exactly is this pasuk referring to? There are a lot of interpretations. This pasuk, once again, is not as obvious as you might think. The first thing that probably comes to mind is, this is why you're not allowed to say God's name in vain. Actually, lahalacha, this is probably not the source of that. The technical context of the pasuk is, it is referring to swearing in the name of God when you're swearing falsely. And that is, by the way, there is no avera for Jews to swear in the name of God to something true. In fact, according to the Rambam, it is a mitzvah saseh in the Torah to swear in the name of God to something true, because you're glorifying God by indicating He is the source of truth. There's a pasuk, ubishmo tishaveya. The Rambam says that's a mitzvah saseh. Now you may ask, so why do Jews in court always say, I affirm, you know, they don't swear, right? Jews, we're always told, don't swear. That's only because, since we're never 100% sure, we're going to be 100% truthful. We might forget something. So the minhag among Klal Yisrael is we try to avoid swearing, because chas v'shalom, it might be untrue. But theoretically, if it's 100% true, not only is it not forbidden, it is actually a mitzvah. And that is why you will find in the Gemara that rabbis of the Talmud, when they were trying to establish the halakha, they would use terms which were shavuos. They would say they swear by God's name. This lashon appears in the Gemara. They tell the story about the Vilna Gaon, that the Vilna Gaon spent some time in prison, actually. It's a whole complicated story. Why? It's a very, very unknown part of the story, but it has to do a little bit with the Vilna Gaon's opposition to Hasidus. I don't know if I want to go more than that, but whatever it is, there were accusations and counter-accusations. The Vilna Gaon finds himself in prison. I had always thought this happened when he was a young man, because he was wandering around, he was arrested for loitering, whatever, but apparently it happened when he was in his 60s. He was already, you know, he was not so young. And eventually he had to be released, or he was released, but he had to take an oath that he was not involved in revolutionary activity. And he took an oath. So they say, in the name of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, that the imprisonment was min hashamayim, because the Vilna Gaon wanted to fulfill, like, all 613 mitzvahs. And one of, I mean, actually this doesn't answer every mitzvah, I don't know, but one of the mitzvahs is to swear by God's name. But he's not involved in business. He would never have occasion to swear. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a circumstance where he had the ability to make a shavua and fulfill the mitzvah, ubishmo tishaveya. So what is the Torah prohibiting in Lo Sisa? It is not prohibiting the mentioning of God's name, although there may be other verses. It's not prohibiting swearing in God's name. It is prohibiting falsely swearing in God's name. Now, and in this way, the word shav, in vain, is equivalent to the idea of sheker. So when a person is nishba b'shem Hashem, l'sheker. Now, keep in mind, it is forbidden to lie even if you don't mention God's name. That's midvar sheker tircha. Not supposed to lie. But the violation of this commandment, which is very severe, is only if you're nishba l'sheker b'shem Hashem. Now, Targum Onkelos points out, and this is fascinating, because normally the Targum Onkelos is very literal, so you don't really see any chidushim in the pasuk unless you read it very carefully. But here the Targum Onkelos has a very big chidush, because you'll note the word shav appears twice. Lo sisa eshem Hashem elokecha lashav, ki lo yinakeh
God will not forgive. So the uncle says shav has two different meanings. The first time shav is mentioned, it means false, lie. The second time is in vain, which is called shav in the Gemara. What is the difference? So we have two types of oaths that are prohibited. One is an oath that is a lie, and the other is an oath that is in vain. Now the Gemara explains the difference. If I swear that a wooden table is gold, that's called sheker. If I swear that the wooden table is wood, that's shav, it's obvious. If you swear on things that are obvious, even if you're not lying, that's a shav, that's a shvuas shav. And that's an aveira too. You swear in God's name when facts are uncertain, when there is a debate, when there's a dispute. You can swear in court. You can swear in Beis Din. Beis Din sometimes administers oaths. But when it's obvious, it's forbidden to swear. And when it's false, it's forbidden to swear. And the uncle says those are the two uses of the word shav, sheker and useless. Right? Both of them are in that pasuk. They tell a story about the Rishash. I don't know if you've heard of Shmuel Strashin. Was a great Talmud Chacham in Vilna in the 19th century. In fact, in the back of every Gemara, we have the commentary of the Rishash, Rav Shmuel. Again, there are two Rishashes. There's Rav Shalom Sharabi, who is a great Mekubal of the 1600s. And among Mekubalim, he's called the Rishash. But in the yeshiva world, the Rishash is Rav Shmuel Strashin. So depending on which circles you're in, when you say Rishash, they'll take two different things. So the story goes that the Rishash was in charge of the tzedakah funds of Vilna. And he would lend out money, and people would pay him back, like a revolving gemach fund. And the Rishash was learning, and a person came by to repay money, and he gave the money to the Rishash, and the Rishash just motioned, put it down. So the person opened up, the Rishash was learning in Gemara, so the person just opened up the rest of the Gemara and stuck the money in. The Rishash was so engrossed, he didn't even notice that the guy paid back the money. So 2 weeks later, he asked the person, you owe the money to the Gemach. I mean, I would be mochel you, but this is tzedakah money. So the person said, I paid you. What's going on? He says, I'm sorry, I have no recollection of your payments. I have to take you to Beis Din. So he took him to Beis Din, which he wouldn't have done on his own debt, and the person said, I paid the money, I don't owe anything. The Rishash says, I'm sorry, I don't think you paid me. And the halacha was the person had to swear. But because the Beis Din was so convinced that the Rishash was telling the truth, he was a gadol, but they couldn't be mechayev him, but they said to the person, don't swear, because they thought chas v'shalom would be a false oath. And the Rishash even said, I'll pay the money myself. Don't. Said, no. I'm not going to let you pay the money, because then people are going to say I'm a ganef, and you didn't want me to swear, so you paid? I'm going to swear! And the story goes that the day he was going to make a shvuah, and al pidin, he had to swear. The dayanim fasted that day, and they came all dressed in kittels like Yom Kippur, because this chas v'shalom, there was going to be a shvuah sheker. And finally, the Rishash says to the person, what can I do? What if I just say you paid? I'll just say you paid and then I'll put in the money, but I'll tell people you paid. He says, no. Because then people are going to say you're such a tzaddik that you were willing to say that I paid in order that I shouldn't swear. That doesn't clear me yet. So the Rishash says, what can I do that will show... Oh yeah, I'm sorry. What then happened in the meantime was that the day of the shvuah, they found the money. The Rishash found the money. So now he doesn't know how to make up to the person. He says, oh, be mafarsein that you paid. He said, nope, not good enough. They'll say you're a tzaddik, etc. He says, what can I do? So he says, well, I have a son and you have a daughter. If we make a shidduch, people will say, oh, he must be an honest man. The Rishash wouldn't marry a person who was into a family who wasn't honest. So the story goes, I do not know the name of the family. Maybe I shouldn't say it if I did know it, but... the story goes, that is how the Strashen Mishpacha and this other Mishpacha got connected through this particular story. So you see the reluctance of Shvuas Emes. Now, let me mention another thing. we talk about, there's a concept in halacha called bracha levatala. Right? You're not supposed to say a blessing in vain. That means if I just want to pick up, if I want to drink water and I say shakol, that's fine. But if I just want to say shakol mi'ebidvaro with Hashem's name, not allowed to do that. Right? Now, what is the source of bracha levatala? So the Rambam actually writes, when a person makes a blessing in vain, that is also a transgression of the negative commandment of lo sisa. You're taking God's name in vain by making a bracha that is not necessary under those circumstances. That's levatala. Ad kedei kach, that even if you're in doubt, let's say I don't remember if I counted the omer, and it's still night. So the halacha is I count, but I don't make a bracha, because since I might have made the bracha, then making the bracha again might be a bracha levatala. You don't do it, even if you're in doubt. However, I want to point out that there are rishonim that say that to oraisa there is no prohibition of bracha levatala, and they make the following arguments. That the iser of mentioning God's name in vain is only if you just mention God's name, or you swear falsely, or you swear uselessly. But when you praise Hashem, even if it's a bracha that you shouldn't be making again, but I say, blessed art you Hashem who makes bread, or whatever it is, that's a shevach, that's a praise, that's a tefillah. So da'oraisa, there's nothing wrong with saying a bracha 100 times a day, because it is derech, shevach, vahodah, it is praise and gratitude, and therefore the iser of bracha levatala, it's still usher, but it is a drabanan dika iser, it is not a doraisa. Okay, so what I'm saying is that the Rambam learns bracha levatala is from losisa, other rishonim say it's a drabanan. Another issue that comes up a lot, comes up in everybody's house all the time, when you sing zmiros, do you say, well, even if you don't repeat, do you say Hashem's name when you sing zmiros? So many people don't. Many people just say Hashem. But once again, me'ikir hadin, it is certainly mutter and even appropriate to say Hashem's name in songs that are praising Him. And the like, you just don't repeat Hashem's name. So sometimes in zmiros it's a little tough when you have refrains that repeat a chorus. So, yeah.
When people,
that's right, that's right. That's correct. And the same thing in the Gemara. When the Gemara, or Pirkei Avos, brings verses from Tanakh, psukim. So, although in the yeshiva world, the normal practice is to say Hashem, but it is actually brought down that in psukim, it is proper to say the name of Hashem in a pasuk. Because this is Kisvei HaKodesh, this is holy writings, and Hashem's name is part of that pasuk. Okay, so generally speaking, all the law, and of course, let me point out that the iser of mentioning God's name in vain does not actually apply to God's name in other languages, which is why you're allowed to say God, so to speak, even though it's the name of Hashem, or a designation, a description of Hashem, because that iser is only in the Hebrew names that are considered to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's names. In fact, the Shach writes that not only are you allowed to say the name of Hashem in other languages, but if you write the name of God in other languages, it could even be erased. So you don't have to write G-D. Even G-O-D is okay, because even if it gets erased, that's actually mutter. Again, I think l'chatchila, it's always good as a matter of chinuch to train people to have reverence for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this is an aspect of reverence. But Me'ikar Hadin, the G-O-D is okay. It's an erasable name of God in a foreign language and the like. Okay, so that's kind of what the Lo Sisa is. It includes a Shavua, Shavua Sheker, or a needless Shavua. According to some, it includes any mention of God's name in vain. There is a machlokes, the Rambam and other Rishonim, if it includes bracha levatala. It does not include, however, saying Hashem's name when you're reading a pasuk, or you're singing zemiros that are praising Hashem, where Hashem's name can be said, but it shouldn't be unduly repeated in a chorus, or you know, by when you sing a line twice, or the like. That's why, you know, even when Baal Kori makes a mistake in the pasuk, we try not to repeat Hashem's name unless he has to go back to the beginning of the pasuk. Okay, so that's kind of things for that commandment. Now, let me just talk a little bit about Shavuos, since it's Erev Shavuos, or not Erev Shavuos, but Shlosha Shemei Hagbalah and the like. Someone had asked a question the other day, just give a quick answer to this, about the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva that died during this period of time, and the Gemara says because they did not show proper respect for each other, how would it be possible that Rabbi Akiva's own students were nichshal in this way, especially since Rabbi Akiva was the one who taught the Ahavta L'Reyecha Kamocha, right? The pasuk, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. And love and respect are connected, obviously, because when you love someone, you truly respect who they are. So how is it shaykh that Rabbi Akiva, who taught this as the most important principle of the Torah, how could it be that his students were nichshal in the very thing that was so important to him? One answer might be very simple. Maybe it's precisely the fact that this was the most important part of his teaching, which meant that they were held to a higher madrega. In other words, when we say they didn't show kavod, it doesn't mean they were all the way at the bottom. Maybe they were better than everybody else in showing kavod, but in Ruchnius, they should have been better than that. Meaning, he made it hard for them in a way. In other words, because it was such a cornerstone of his teaching, if you didn't absorb it to the highest level, that was already something very bad. It could also be like this. Rav Hirsch points out, and I mentioned this before, that the idea of kavod is not simply being polite to somebody, but it comes from the word heaviness, significance, weight, looking at a person and seeing them as significant. This is an important idea, because we can be very nice to people, but we consider them lightweights. We consider them insignificant. By the way, this is sometimes an occupational hazard in the field of Kiruv Rechokim, where sometimes the Makarev has kind of the attitude that we are in possession of the truth, and here is an empty vessel that we will fill up with our wisdom, our knowledge, and our insights. And hopefully that person will not contribute any of the garbage that he brings from the outside. Well, besides the fact that in many ways that's counterproductive, because when people feel they're being condescended to, they shut down. But it also is the opposite of what kavod is. Because kavod is looking at another human being and understanding that they have what they're bringing to the table. They have significance. They have weight. Now, it could be the following idea. When you have a teacher as great as Rabbi Akiva, perhaps you assume that all of your Torah will come via the conduit to the teacher, and you see less importance in the interaction among the Talmid. In other words, each one of us will connect to the master, and we don't need each other. And that is kind of the lack of kavod. That might be the occupational hazard of having a great teacher. When you have a great teacher, there's sometimes a hazard that you see less in the interactive stimulation that you have with each other. And yet, what do Chazal say? Chazal say the opposite. Chazal say that one of the great rabbis said, I have learned much from my teachers, but from my colleagues more, and from my students the most. So it could be that was the idea, that each one was connected to Rabbi Akiva, and therefore they didn't see the kavod in each other. That's why even in different yeshivas, you know, it's interesting that there were many great yeshivas in Europe, in which the Rosh Yeshiva's shir was not considered to be that important. The Rosh Yeshiva gave a shir, but it was kind of take it or leave it. A lot of people didn't go, and then they weren't expected to go. The primary idea of the yeshiva was the interaction among the Talmidim, in which each one, yeshivas were different. Some yeshivas, the shir was the highlight, and you spent your whole day preparing for the shir. But in a yeshiva like Voloshin, which, believe me, had the highest quality gedolim, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and the Netziv, the shir was, you know, you went or you didn't go. You know, the main point was the learning from each other. And maybe that was what was missing, perhaps, in Rabbi Akiva. The other point I wanted to share with you is a beautiful vort from Rav Tzadok. Rav Tzadok points out that when we describe Matan Torah, the Torah gives us a whole the Torah gives us a whole sound and light show. Lahavdil, a Cecil B. DeMille extravaganza. And it talks about everybody saw thunder and lightning. Of course, Chazal already remarked that this was a nace, that you saw the thunder, right? The vision, the sounds were turned into visual stimuli and the like. And then Hashem gives the Aseres HaDibros. And after he gives the Aseres HaDibros, it then repeats. They saw the kolos, they saw the sounds, the eshalapidim, and the torches. So Rav Tzadok notes a little thing that would escape our notice. And that is, before Matan Torah, they saw Barakim, flashes of lightning. After Matan Torah, they saw Lapidim, torches. There was a difference in the visualization here, from Barak to Lapid. Barakim to Lapidim. Rav Tzadok wants to suggest that the difference in the visualization represented the spiritual transformation in the understanding of holiness pre-Matan Torah and after Matan Torah. Pre-Matan Torah, holiness was like a barak. After Matan Torah, holiness became a lapid. What's the difference? Rav Tzadok says, even before the Torah was given, the human neshama, not even the neshama of a Jew, has a yearning to be united with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a yearning for transcendence, a yearning to be connected to something greater than the animalistic part of their personalities. But by definition, the only way one could achieve Kedusha is by escaping the physical boundaries of this world. That within the confines of physicality, there is no way to achieve Kedusha. That is why in other religions, by and large, the way extreme holiness is achieved is by asceticism, renunciation, separation from the world. The Catholic priest takes a vow of celibacy. And unfortunately, we've seen in recent years, how relatively unsuccessful that has been, but understandably so. And I'm not condoning, of course, but understandably, you're taking what is a natural part of human life and you're perverting it by not allowing it to have its expression. Or a vow of poverty, etc. Because the world in that paradigm is regarded as evil and degrading, and my connection to God can exist only to the extent I disengage from that world. Rav Tzadok says, that type of holiness is like a flash of lightning. Because what is a flash of lightning? Brilliant light! The moment of ecstasy! But then you're plunged into total darkness till the next brilliant flash of light. Because you have to eat, you have to sleep, you have to leave the mountaintop occasionally. And therefore, by definition, the Kedusha is not sustainable. It cannot keep you going. It's going to be brilliant Kedusha followed by depths of despair. The Torah taught a great chiddush to mankind, to Bnei Yisrael in particular, that you achieve Kedusha not by rejecting the world and retreating into the spirit, but you achieve Kedusha by taking the physicality of the world and elevating it. The sexual urge is not repressed, but it is sanctified and elevated in the context of a sanctified holy union that we call Kedushin, marriage. Eating and drinking to serve Hashem becomes a mitzvah. We honor the Shabbos with the meals that we do. The Torah is teaching us, you serve Hashem not by escaping physicality. You serve Hashem by transforming the physical into the spiritual. Rav Tzadok says, that is compared to a torch. Because what is the difference between lightning and a torch? Lightning is a brilliant flash of light that then plunges you into darkness. A torch keeps on going. It flickers. Now, Rav Tzadok suggests, and this is a very interesting idea, that there's kind of a tragic compromise here. Because a torch is not as bright as a lightning flash. And indeed, Rav Tzadok says that in daily life, you will often not have the ecstasy or the magic moments of the hermit who is on top of the flagpole or on top of the mountain. Whether it's carpool or cleaning or cooking for Shabbos or whatever it would be, there is a certain amount of drudgery in daily life. It doesn't have the excitement. So you don't have the lightning flash, but you have the permanence. You have the sustainability. With a torch, you get warmth as well as light. With a torch, you can navigate. Again, think about the... Now it's much better than it used to be. Those new roads with Sfat, you know, now they have... if you remember the older roads, where you had to wind around the mountain over and over and over and over again in a spiral. You still do a little bit. The Eged buses, and every time it turns a curve, you know, you're saying Tehillim, you know, with a lot of kavana and the like. So imagine if you had to navigate in total darkness through the occasional lightning flash. Not too good. With a torch, you can manage to get there. Actually, Amuka is that way. Amuka, which is near, you know, so that's the Yerushim Ben Uziel's Kever. That's like totally dark. It's amazing. It's amazing. Amazing how and literally you only have like the headlights is the only light that you have there at all. So Rav Tzadok says, this is what Matan Torah is. Matan Torah is taking the paradigm of Kedusha that was based on brilliant light alternating with total darkness to have a certain constancy, stability, the flickering torch which sustains me, to recognize that there doesn't have to be a fragmentation between the physical and the spiritual. But in fact, we can take everything physical in this world and elevate it and serve Hashem that way. And this actually explains a well-known Gemara. You know, there's a machlokas in the Gemara. What is the proper way to celebrate every Yom Tov? Because one pasuk says Yom Tov is for Hashem, and another pasuk says Yom Tov is for us. Which one? So Rabbi Eliezer says, you got a choice. You can devote Yom Tov totally to Hashem. Learn and daven and don't eat. He heals, you're allowed to fast on Yom Tov. Rabbi Yoshua says you don't have a choice. You have to divide the Yom Tov. Some of it for Hashem and some of it for your physical pleasure. We paskin like Rabbi Yoshua. But then the Gemara says the following. The machlokes, whether you have this option, is only for Pesach or Sukkot. But when it comes to Shavuos, everybody says, even Rabbi Eliezer that says, you could normally give it totally to Hashem, says you have to eat a meal on Shavuos. Because it's the day we got the Torah. Now, in a way, that's a non sequitur. I would have expected the Gemara to say that even the one that says you have to make a meal on Shavuos would say, all you have to do is learn because it's the day of the Torah. The Gemara says the opposite. Shavuos is the one day you must have a meal. Because here's the answer. If the idea of the Torah is we take the physical and sanctify it, for me to simply say on Shavuos I'm just going to learn, that would miss the point. Because the angels are better than us in that. Remember, there was a whole debate. The angels, the Malachi Asharei, said to Hashem, The Jews don't, why should they get the Torah?
They're so inferior to us. And Moshe Rabbeinu's argument was, yes, but the Torah has physical commandments that you're not connected to. Now, if all we're going to do is spiritual work, the angels are much better than us in purely spiritual work. So why should we get the Torah at all? It's our physicality that entitles us to the Torah. Right, so this is what Rav Tzadok says. This is the idea of the thunder, of the lightning turning into the torch. And that's an important idea, that one should understand that the most physical, mundane tasks in life, when they are undertaken with the right kavana, the right perspective, become ways of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Two people can be doing the same thing, and for one person it's nothing, and for the other person it's a great mitzvah. You know, they tell a story. Now, this is one of these stories that are cross-religious stories, because there's a Christian version, there's an Islamic version, there's a Jewish version. So sometimes, I'm not sure, sometimes even the Jewish stories that are not in the Midrashim were actually borrowed from some Christian guy who had a good story. But this is the story that they tell. I'm not even sure which version I'm going to tell you, but it's just different versions. But it's the version about three people were cutting stones, were schlepping stones for the building of Taj Mahal, some cathedral, or not the Beis HaMikdash, because you can't cut stones, but a Beis Knesset. Right, so it comes in three versions, as I say. Each person was asked, how would you define your life? One person says, my life is about cutting stones from morning to night. I cut them, I drag them, I go back and I cut and I drag and I cut and I drag. That is what I do for 12 hours a day. I go home, eat bread, go to sleep, get up and do it again. That's my life. Another person said, my life is about making a living for my children so that one day they'll be able to have something better. And as I cut the stones, I think about how I'm helping my children. That's a second perspective. And a third person says, every stone I cut, I'm giving glory to my Creator and praise to the greatness of who He is. Same thing, same activity. One person sees it as drudgery and repetitiveness with no meaning at all. The other person sees it as a way of taking care of those he loves. And a third person even goes further and sees this as praise for Hashem. Perceptions create the realities. How we perceive the life that we live becomes the life that we have. And this is exactly how you have to take the torches, which are less intense than the flashes of lightning, but understand that they are the guideposts that will bring you to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, be it as it may, I wish you all a Zman Matan Torah. You know, one final thought. You know, we often say that Shavuos is the day of Kabbalah HaTorah, and yet that's not what we say in davening. In davening we say it's the day of the giving of the Torah. We don't say it's the day of Kabbalah HaTorah. And the Hasidic Sfarim say very pashut. Matan Torah was an event. God gave us the Torah. But accepting the Torah, every single day we have to re-accept it. And therefore, Kabbalah HaTorah is not a historical event. It is a continuous process. So we're going to be commemorating Matan Torah on Wednesday. But we will be actually accepting Matan Torah, not just on Wednesday, but actually every day, but especially on Wednesday. So may you have a commemoration of Matan Torah, and may you experience an actual Kabbalah HaTorah. So good job to you. How we perceive life becomes the life that we have.
Yeah.
I'm going to hear you tonight, but it's a different lecture, right?
It's a different lecture, yes.
Okay. Let's say I don't mind.
Are you speaking tonight?
Huh?
Are you speaking
tonight? I'm speaking tonight, yeah.
Do you want to say where?
Yeah, for those who are interested, this is I'm speaking tonight at 8 o'clock at Matan, wherever that is. This is in memory of a very fine woman who lived in Silver Spring, Susan Siegel, Zichrono Livracha.